This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Hello and welcome to Needs No Introduction, fresh ideas from speakers of note, a Rabble.ca podcast. I'm Victoria Fenner. On today's program, did you know the new iPhone sold on the first weekend of its launch in fall 2014 had 25% more computing power than all of the computers on Earth in 1995? Staggering. That statistic comes to us from Robert McChesney, one of the two speakers on today's program. And what's even more staggering is what those phones and the companies that make them are doing to us. Those are just a couple of examples of the compelling ideas in this talk. Who Will Win the Digital Revolution was a fundraiser for Open Media and Media Democracy Days. It was held on Sunday, March 6th at the Vancouver Public Library on the unceded and occupied Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. The speakers you'll hear are leading thinkers on media reform. Robert McChesney and John Nichols are co-authors of the book People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Here is Who Will Win the Digital Revolution, introduced by Josh Tavish, the campaign's director of Open Media.
Who here worries that journalism is in a state of crisis? Who here thinks citizens should be at the center of government decision-making, not be ignored or be given a tokenistic seat at the table? And importantly for tonight, who here, at least some of the time, struggles to reconcile their excitement for new technology with a kind of deep fear about how powerful and entrenched interests want us to use that technology? Unless we develop a positive vision and a bold strategy for where we want to steer this digital revolution as a society, we're going to be in big trouble. It's here that I turn to one of the great kind of modern advocates and thinkers on democracy, technology, and the open internet, Aaron Schwartz. While we lost Aaron a few years ago, I was reviewing some of his writing, and I think it's worth quoting here. In 2009, at the age of 22, Schwartz was lamenting the United States economic crisis and the failure of progressive thinkers to articulate a positive, alternative vision for reinvigorating democracy. At the time, Schwartz wrote, "If there was ever a time for a new program, this would seem to be it. The economic crisis has shattered the Washington consensus more than 1,000 Noam Chomsky op-eds ever could, while the internet has made it possible to organize people by the million. But we can't seem to move beyond our reactive stance," he wrote. If you want books that criticize the policies of the Bush administration, you could fill a whole library. But if you want a book on what to do instead, where do you go? After some rumination, Schwartz took a stab at an alternative. What did he call this alternative? Democracy. Schwartz wrote, "Democracy, media democracy, to prevent the population from being misled by deluded elites with big megaphones. Economic democracy, to promote a better mix and fairer distribution of society and necessary evil. And political democracy, so that our militaries aren't led by murderous thugs into endless immoral engagements." But one challenge remained for Schwartz. He said, "Intellectuals on our side need to move away from simply poking holes in the dominant consensus to clearly articulating their alternative and propose concrete methods for promoting it." Schwartz concluded, "I hope that more people will, because I sometimes fear that if not, there may not be too many public intellectuals left anymore." It is this plea from Schwartz that is the reason that I fucking love Robert McChesney and John Nichols. They are not doomsdayers. They are not naysayers. They are not merchants of fear. These guys are the real deal. And they believe that if we can stand together, not only can we fight back, but we can reimagine democracy together. I'm so glad to have them here tonight. Their new book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy, meticulously assesses the state of the digital revolution and definitively charts our options for steering it in a direction that either empowers or disempowers citizens. It is with this that I'd like to set up our main event here tonight, the reason you're all here. Robert McChesney is the Gutskill Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois. He is the author and editor of 23 books. His work's been translated into 30 languages. Is the co-founder of Free Press, a national media forum organization, reform organization in the U.S. that inspired a lot of open media's approach. John Nichols is a pioneering political blogger and has written for The Nation's online beat since 1999, is their Washington, D.C. correspondent, and is a contributing writer to The Progressive and In These Times. He's also the associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and a co-founder of Free Press. Get ready as I invite Bob McChesney and John Nichols to take over.
Well, thank you, Josh, for that very nice introduction. Thank you all for coming out. It's a pleasure to be here. And I know you took you away from the Whitecaps game, which we heard all about as we got into our hotel room today. We're going to talk about our book, and it has an American bias, unfortunately, because it really deals directly with American politics. But it's actually a global book, because what we describe is absolutely going on everywhere in the world. There's not a single corner of the world, from Tierra del Fuego to the Bering Straits, that is not affected by what we're about to talk about. And so you'll forgive me for the American bias, because that's the politics we know of the best. That's where we can write the most authority. And when we wrote the book, our argument was, in a nutshell, that we're hitting a new stage of the digital revolution that's going to make what we've seen in the last 30 years really look like small potatoes, really child's play with what's about to hit us in the next 5 or 10 or 15 years. And it's going to create an enormous political crisis that's going to fundamentally change the political calculus everywhere in the world. And we anticipated that this was going to really hit hard. We wouldn't see much of this until later. We finished the book at the end of last year, and we wouldn't notice much about it till, you know, a few years from now that it would really start hitting. And then in the United States, something really interesting happened. The Bernie Sanders campaign came along, which we basically predict something like that in the book, and it exploded in prominence. And it exploded in prominence with a degree of youth support that's unprecedented in American politics. There's never been any politician who's gotten the sort of percentages of people supporting him under the age of 25 or 30 ever in American history, to my knowledge, the best we can tell. I mean, there are numbers that are simply unbelievable. It's like you have to go to like a Soviet election to find that much support for one candidate from young people or any age. And in doing this, if you read our book, one of the things we try to explain in our book is why the world is changing so rapidly, and young people are sort of at the cutting edge of it. They're the ones tasting it first. And I was talking to, I'm an old timer, I've got two daughters in their 20s. I was talking to Bob Hackett here, and he's got two kids in the 20s. And anyone who has kids in the 20s knows what kids in the 20s are going through, because they're usually living at your house, or you're kicking them out of your house, or some combination of that. Because this is really a horrible time to be a young person economically. Economically, the way the world's working today, we're seeing a stagnant, failing capitalism worldwide, with growing inequality, increasing poverty. Working conditions suck. I mean, the pensions, forget about it if you're young. The sort of stability that people assumed would come with labor when I was 25 years old, unthinkable today. It's not a very good looking picture at all. Now, in combination with this sort of very depressing situation, such that for young people today, it's the worst economy since the 1930s. For college graduates, it was better in the 1930s because there were fewer college graduates, so you could actually get jobs. But the problem is magnified by the fact that we have a political crisis in the United States, similar worldwide, but very bad in the United States, where our democratic system, our governing system, democracy would be an unfair way to describe it, but our governing system is completely corrupt and ineffectual. So we have an immense problem there that has to be solved in a political system that's incapable of solving it or addressing it meaningfully. And that's sort of the tension out of this, that the Sanders explosion has taken place. Now, if you know Sanders at all, if you followed his campaign, he argues we need a political revolution. For exactly that reason, we have to democratize the society to solve the fundamental economic problems of our times in a radical manner. So that's his stump speech, and that's sort of where our book tees off. That's where it starts from, that point. Now, this is what we add to it. This is what our book's about. What we argue is that the digital revolution we're all familiar with, that we have cell phones and World Wide Web and all that stuff, That's a profound revolution. That's a revolution that certainly, I think, scholars would say is the equivalent of the printing press or the alphabet or writing, maybe even language itself. It's that fundamental in redefining the nature of life as we're experiencing it on Earth. So it's one of the big ones. It changes everything. It's much bigger than television. I mean, it's a whole quantum leap above something like television. But we think we're on the verge now, and we're in the midst now, is a better way to put it, of the next stage, which is the growth of artificial intelligence and the ability basically to eliminate much of human labor. And not 50 or 80 years from now, but real soon. I mean, a lot of these jobs could go now. And that's going to dramatically change everything politically. So we have a terrible labor market to begin with, and then we're about to introduce some technologies that can wipe out the jobs, a lot of the jobs that actually remain still. You know, it's going to raise the temperature in the room quite a bit, and that's the moment we're entering. How many jobs we lose, no one knows. But the Oxford study from a couple years ago suggested 50%. Eric Schmidt at Google gave a speech at Davos 2 years ago, in which he basically made it sound like that's not an unrealistic number for the next two decades of existing jobs without anyone seeing anything coming along to replace them. I'll give a story that took place recently. The CEO of a German company, one of the largest industrial companies in the world, was at a private dinner in Germany, the room roughly this size, but of the German elite. And I had a friend, a PhD student of mine, who actually worked at Free Press, who lives in Germany, was invited to the dinner, so he was there to witness it. And I would tell you his name and everything about this, but it was a private event, so I'm sworn to secrecy at that level. But this person, who employs several hundred thousand people to well-paying jobs in Germany and around the world, the CEO, was asked about automation and whether that would ever affect his company's operations. And he said, we actually have the technology now to automate all our factories worldwide if we want to. It's there. We have that capacity. And he said, the only thing that's really holding us back right now from doing it is that if we were to do that, the middle class in Germany, he said, would burn. There would be no middle class left. And these are all great union jobs, the sort of jobs that we used to have in America like 30 years ago. And they used to have in Ontario when you had the auto industry there. Those jobs would be gone. And that's sort of the moment we're at. The technology's there. It's the politics now they're working on. And it's just a matter of time. I'll give you one other example of what we're facing. DARPA, which is in the United States, is connected to the Pentagon. It's called the Defense Advanced Research Program. It's the people who did much of the research that created the internet over the last 50 years. It still really guides a lot of the cutting edge research in digital technology that influences where things are going. DARPA has, for the last 10 years, had a special project in robotics with huge prizes for innovation. And the guy who ran the robotics project at DARPA left last summer and wrote an article for a journal on what they're working on and what it's going to mean. And he said, the only way to really understand what's happening with the digital revolution, the next stage, is to understand that it's nothing like, you know, the alphabet or speech or the printing press. It's really the way what's coming down the line. The comparison would be to the Cambrian explosion. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Cambrian explosion. I thought it was an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. So I looked it up. The Cambrian explosion refers to that period 540 million years ago in which life went from single cell and simplistic organisms to complex organisms. And it's a relatively brief 20 million year period, but things like walking, vision, all sorts of things that didn't exist suddenly blossomed. There's literally an explosion in life, and it got us to where we are today. He said, that's what we're going into. We're going into a Cambrian explosion. So everything until now has been single-cell amoebas, and we're about to go into a Cambrian explosion. That's what he said we're looking at. That's the sort of stuff they're working on. And among other things he said, to sort of follow up the story, he said, one of the things that artificial intelligence will be able to do very soon, that it's already beginning to do, is have complete vision faculties, be able to see. and since that came in the Cambrian explosion, that seemed appropriate. Now, this has been implicit in the digital revolution from the very beginning, this sort of automation. In fact, when the first computers came along in the 1940s, there were already lots of articles about this is going to end labor almost immediately. I mean, Fortune magazine ran an article on the end of labor in 1946, 2 years after computers first began. They were already understood that the ability, what computers could do, could really eliminate much of the need for human labor. By the 1960s, this became a big issue. There was lots of press coverage of it, books written. There was all sorts of hysteria that all the jobs in the world were going to be gone by the end of the 1960s. And now we read this stuff, and I read it for the book. We write about it at some length in chapter two in the book. And it's laughable that they were so concerned, because back then the technology was so primitive. How could they possibly think these enormous, slow, clunker computers that, you know, like your cell phone, to get the power of a cell phone back then, it would take three rooms this size to fit it. How could they possibly think that could replace all human labor? It couldn't, and it didn't really happen. But computers have grown in tremendous power since then. You're all, I suspect, familiar with the term Moore's Law, the idea that computer power doubles every year and a half, roughly. And it's proven astonishingly accurate. Well, if you take 2 to increase the power of what 2 goes to by doubling it every year and a half, what you find is after about 40 or 50 years, when you're doubling it, you're giving some unbelievably mind-boggling increases in power. And that's what's happening right now with computers. And it's been happening. We're entering sort of uncharted territory in which computers now are able to do stuff that was unthinkable just a few years ago. To give some, we go at length in the book on this point. I'll just leave a couple of things here. Just the new iPhones that were sold in the fall of 2014, the first weekend that the new iPhones were released in the fall 2014, the iPhone 6, I think it was, John? Yes. 6? Just the power of just the iPhone sold that weekend had 25 times more power than all the computers in the world in 1995. Just those iPhones sold that weekend. 25 times more power than all the computers in the world in 1995. And imagine that increasing at an exponential rate 10, 20 years out from 2014. That's what we're in now. And that's why we're talking about a Cambrian explosion, the sort of things that can be done. Now, the guy at DARPA said, we don't know how this is going to change the human race. He said, the only thing we know for certain, it's going to eliminate most jobs. When exactly, we don't know, but a lot of them fairly soon. That's sort of what we're hearing. Now, this raises some real problems for capitalism. And it raises real problems for society, for the economy, fundamental existential questions. Really, we're in a situation now where we need very few people to produce what we need to sustain life. We don't need all of us to work all the time. Now, it used to be that was good news. That's great, man. Don't have to work so hard. I can do poetry. I can, you know, jog, do whatever I want. And everyone can live a comfortable life. That was the theory. Under capitalism, it doesn't quite work that way, though. It's sort of the opposite effect. This ability to be able to have fewer and fewer people produce more and more, that much less labor is needed, turns into instead a situation where the economy doesn't really work. There's no one who can buy products, so there's no incentive to invest. So instead of having a bounty and a whole different type of economy, you have the stagnation gets worse, the poverty grows, the insecurity grows. And that's the moment we're entering. This is why this is such a troubling moment to have this revolution in a troubling context for it to take place in. We argue in the book that clearly what we need is a post-capitalist economy. We need to have an economy where these technologies make our lives better, work for us, not imprison us into poverty and joblessness. And that's the great political question of our time. How do we get there? What do we do to get a post-capitalist economy? And our argument, and this I think pertains to the introduction and pertains to Aaron Schwartz's comments from the introduction that Josh gave, is that the solution is real clear. It's democracy. The solution is we need to extend and strengthen democratic practices and institutions so that people can participate in reconstructing the society and the economy. And if we don't have a democratic solution to it, decisions will be made by elites to serve their interests. And we've seen enough of history, we've seen enough of how the world works around us. That will not be a solution that necessarily is going to be very good for most people in the world. As the great saying goes in the United States, if you're not at the table when a decision's being made, you're what's being served. And so democracy means everyone gets a seat at the table. Now, how do you do that? What does that mean? How do you democratize a society? We argue that the crucial thing for society is to build out what we call the democratic infrastructure. The democratic infrastructure is, if you understand an economic infrastructure, you can't just start an economy, start a business or an enterprise or a co-op willy-nilly. You need to have transportation infrastructure, communication, electric, water infrastructure. You need all sorts of things, a legal infrastructure, to make it possible to do an economic activity. Well, the same thing's true for democracy. Just having the right to vote is insufficient. You really need a lot of other things to give individuals the power so they can be effective participants in governance. Some of this is pretty obvious: fair elections, the ability to vote, what, of course, open media deals with when there are signs up there. You know, having credible journalism. You need checks on inequality, things like progressive taxation. You need to have checks on militarism. These are the things that are the cancers that destroy the democratic infrastructure, make it harder for societies to be self-governing. Healthcare is a right, free quality education, so everyone is educated. That's a core part of a democratic infrastructure. Checks on corruption. This is what you have to build out to have the basis, the foundation, so that you can have a self-governing society. Now, in the United States, conservatives in particular, but not just conservatives, oftentimes say, well, we've never had that in America. That's not the American way. That's I don't know what that is, but it's not American democracy. you know, American democracy is everyone's in it for themselves. The government's job is just to get out of the way and fight wars, and it's left to people to get as rich as possible, and whoever dies with the most money wins. And in fact, that's a very misleading view of American history. It's a very misleading view of any country's history. In fact, in our book, we go through the battle to build a democratic infrastructure in U.S. history. And what we discover is from the very beginning of the country, it was a central fight, building out these institutions to empower people so they could actually participate. It's had ebbs and flows, but really right back to the Constitution, you see it. And what we discovered, and I think it's true in many countries in the world, Canada too, but especially we discovered the United States, is from about 1900 to 1970, the United States became a vastly more democratic country, a much more egalitarian country, much more social mobility, a better country. For one thing, in 1900, a very small percentage of the population still was actively voting in elections. Women couldn't vote, African Americans couldn't vote in the South. By 1970, finally, the entire adult population was allowed to vote in America. We became a modern liberal democracy. But it was much more than that. We built out things like the right to labor unions, Social Security, old age pensions, like that, public education. We basically had virtually free public higher education in America by the 1960s, now considered a radical idea when someone proposes it, but was taken for granted in California and New York State 50 years ago. we built out the democratic infrastructure. We had less inequality in America by 1970 than ever in the country's history, certainly far less than we have today. So this is a period we look at. This is a period that sort of shows us an interesting path we can learn from as we try to deal with the crisis we face today. And in the book, we look specifically at two periods that we think are of particular importance to understand the crisis we're about to go into. The first one is the 1930s, the Depression. And the reason why this is so important, this is a period in Canada and the United States and Europe in which there was massive unemployment. Similar to the unemployment, underemployment we're about to experience, we're just beginning to experience now, and we're going to continue to experience. And how do countries deal with massive unemployment in the 1930s? Well, this is where the historical record's very important. One way was the U.S., the New Deal, sort of social democracy, what took place in Western Europe, which was basically to build out the democratic infrastructure, and build out democracy and have the state play a large role enhancing the role of workers in the society, to varying degrees depending upon the country. The other option, though, was fascism. The other option in the most advanced and powerful country in Europe, Germany at the time, with mass unemployment, was to turn to fascism, which is sort of the revolutionary idea that people would organize to get rid of democracy, and that it would be a state that would work closely with the dominant economic interests to run the country and prevent the masses from really getting in their way. Now, when we first wrote the first draft of this book, John and I, and we showed this section of the book to our editor in New York, she said, you know, we called it the F word. We couldn't even use it, fascism. We said, we called it the F word. She said, you know, no one's going to buy this. No one's going to say, this is crazy talk. You know, no one's going to believe the fascism's a threat anymore. We got rid of that 50 years ago. And then Donald Trump came along. And I said, you know, I think you're onto something here, you know. And Donald Trump is responding to these pressures. If you know what's going on with the bottom 50% of American population, it's a depression in America. It is a depression, and this is what happens. The center is collapsing. It's bankrupt. It's not working. And these are the options that emerge: a democratic left or a fascist right. And why the 30s and 40s is so important is because that was when fascism emerged. That's precisely when the United States and other countries of the world said, what can we do as we battle against the Nazis, as we battle against fascism, to make sure this never comes back again? How can we prevent this scourge of fascism from ever returning? FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, the American president at the time, put a lot of energy into this issue, studied it, wrote about it, and he argued, and I think accurately, that fascism emerged in countries where the democracy was weak, it was corrupt, and had lost credibility. And the foundation of returning, making it so fascism would never return to the society, was to build out and strengthen the democracy. And specifically, in his State of the Union address in 1944, he said the United States Constitution should add a series of new amendments, new rights to people, that if we put these in, we'll pretty much guarantee we'll never have to worry about fascism in this country. The right to an education, the right to a job at a living wage, the right to health care, the right to not have business monopolies that dominate the economy and the government. These are things that should be in our Constitution. This is what we have to do to guarantee we never have fascism again. It was very prescient. In fact, the vision he put forward there, and I'm just giving you a taste of it, was later adopted by Martin Luther King in the 1960s, almost verbatim, to be his freedom budget. And it also became the core of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which Eleanor Roosevelt took from Franklin's 1944 address. So that was a response to how you deal with fascism and prevent it from returning. I think there's a lot to learn there. The next period, the second period we study at length, and I'll end on this, was in the 1960s and early 70s. That's when that automation boom took place that I talked about. But it's also a very important period because this was the first time society really dealt with the idea of living in a post-scarcity world. What would it be like to live in a world in which for the first time humanity did not have to be obsessed with its material survival, that it could actually do something different? And our greatest economists, John Stuart Mill, John Maynard Keynes, Marx, had all considered this in varying ways. This was a central, Thurston Veblen. How do we deal with this moment that's coming? And in the 1960s, it became not a hypothetical thing. We're at a point now that we're in a situation where a lot of people won't have to work that much and we can have a very satisfactory standard of living. And it started a whole new discussion. And what's interesting about this period, the democratic infrastructure was fairly strong. And what we saw was capitalism, American capitalism, was hitting its peak. It was probably the strongest period of the 20th century, if not its entire history. Yet at the exact same time, it was at its all-time peak in terms of standard of living. I think working class wages probably at their all-time highest by the early 1970s in real terms. At this exact same period, we have a very strong left, stronger than we had seen in a long time, a social movement saying we can still do a lot better. We can make this a much better country. The civil rights movement, feminist, black power, I mean, on and on, consumer movement with Nader. And the whole impetus of the movement was to take up FDR's call from the 40s and to really expand the democratic infrastructure and to go to a post-capitalist society. It was really a striking period that's been largely forgotten. We write about it at some length. And the reason why it's been largely forgotten is that by the early 1970s, the American business community, you've probably heard of those guys, the corporations that run our country, banded together and they really said, we've got to take the government over here. We've got to change it and go back to the days that, as John Adams put it, those who own the country should govern it. And they instituted enormous lobbying, enormous public relations. They set up a system, the corruption that's in place today, such that in 1970, when a person retired from a job in Congress, they usually would go back home and teach at a college for a couple of years. Today, well over half the people who leave Congress become million-dollar-a-year lobbyists in Washington. That industry didn't even exist in 1970, K Street. But now it's a $9 billion-a-year industry of people who make a fortune lobbying for corporations in Congress. And the corruption has been built in, and the whole movement that government can only really not serve people, but it should be there to serve the business interests has taken over. The counter-revolution is the moment we're in today. And because of this counter-revolution, people oftentimes have been depressed. Much of my academic career, and I think those who are my age have fought it, have been dealing with people and walking around in varying degrees of depression about how hopeless it seems living in this world when the system is so incapable of dealing with the great crises around us. And I'm here with the good news. You're probably saying, this is the guy supposed to have the good news. That's how I was introduced. You're wondering, where's the good news? The good news is that period's coming to an end. It's over. That period is now dead. The young people of America are voting with their feet on that one. I think they probably are worldwide. That period of neoliberal, whoever makes the most money wins, government should work for them, it can't do anything for us, that's not working anymore. That's officially exhausted. Now it hangs on by power of corruption, but it hangs on with no legitimacy otherwise. And it will have much less legitimacy in coming years. That's the great struggle. But we're entering a new movement. We're entering a new time period where we're going to have to deal with what's coming at us. And we face frightening prospects if nothing changes, but something will change. But we also face a moment we're entering quickly, and the more social activism is, the sooner that moment comes, in which seems like impossible problems suddenly, when you have people actively engaged politically, become extraordinary opportunities. And that's our job, to turn impossible problems into extraordinary opportunities. So how do we do that? Well, when I want to talk politics and figure out how to solve a problem politically, historically, or especially right now, I go to John Nichols, my dear friend, and he'll take it from here.
Oh, thank you for the excellent handoff, Bob. I was just wandering around taking pictures of you, and mainly from the back, so it's not actually spying in any official sense. But I was very happy that Josh, in his introduction, referenced the concern about a media that no longer simply provides us with information, but that in fact culls us for information. And that's probably the best way to understand the moment that we have entered into. We like to romantically believe that media today is still what it might once have been. It is not. Media today is something so radically different than what it has ever been that if we think about it in the old ways, if we think about it as we historically have, we become exactly what those who own media want us to be. We are disempowered. We are not citizens. We are not consumers. We are actually just a great big mass of economic opportunities for incredibly wealthy people who have already redistributed most of the wealth upwards. And yet they're looking out at us and they're thinking, you know, we can probably still shake a little more out of them. But how will we do it? What will we do to get that last bit out of them? I know. We'll give them phones. And those phones will become so addictive that even as they stand or sit or go to the restroom, they will still be looking at the phone. Right? And because there'll be some bit of information that they can get. And they will think that they are being rapidly empowered. When in fact, every keystroke that we give them is another bit of information that they will sell to someone else. We are in one of the great horror films of the past. No, we are all the scary films, because it's always like, you know, at the end of the movie, you find out that the book To Serve Man is a cookbook. We're in a movie where our technological progress is an economic strategy. And we need to get up, walk out of the theater, take a big, deep breath of all that air around us. Put the phone down. Don't abandon it, because it's a wonderful tool and it has tremendous possibilities. But put the phone. Give me the phone. Come on. Give me the phone. I know you can do it. And look around at the reality of our times. And Bob, who's the optimist of our group, Bob has just given you a cheery little rumination on our moment. But I'm not sure you fully get it. So before we turn toward what we will do about this, let me just take you one more step down that slippery slope. And I believe everyone's left their razor blades at the door. Everyone here is totally ready to experience just a little bit of the future. So let me tell you about it. 15,000 young people across this world have already sent away for a chip, which they can physically themselves insert in their finger, cut their finger open, and put a chip into their finger so that they can open doors, turn on computers, and otherwise move through life just with their finger. They are physically altering themselves. And when they are surveyed for why they physically are altering themselves, they say because they think it will give them a leg up in the job sector. It's not like, oh, I'm this innovative person of the future. It's that if I've got this chip in me, if I have physically altered myself, I might be able to get a job. And why would they think that? What would possibly possess them to think that they must have to actually insert microtechnology into themselves in order to be a part of the future? Well, because they actually know more than most of us do. I go around the world, I spend an immense amount of time at technology conferences, and at conferences sponsored by multinational corporations, by really, really powerful, rich people. They let me in because they want to feel like they have a diverse and, you know, great discussion going on and critiques and stuff like that. And they think I'm going to say something to them. I actually just take notes. And it's daunting. They literally do sit around and talk about how many jobs they can eliminate. And it is with giant gleeful smiles. And these are not sadistic people. They drink mineral water. They wear very snappy European suits, like that guy. And no, they're really charming folks, but they literally, they have these like fancy things that they run up on their screens, and they literally show, well, we can wipe out this sector of the economy, and the revenues from that will be immense. And you're thinking to yourself, hold it, I'm smarter than those rich guys. Because I know if they wipe out all the jobs, then they won't get any money. Ah, but this is the funny part about those who have already figured out how to squeeze so much out of us. They're good at that. They're really, really, really good at that. You know, in the 1950s, one member of a family could work and generally support a family, right? They had a union job. They had, you know, they sustained themselves. That doesn't exist anymore. Now, both parents are working, right? And we're trying to figure out something we could send the kid out to do to make it bring in a few extra bucks. We have entered into a point where people work dramatically harder in much of the world for dramatically less money. And the funny thing about it is we have taught multinational corporations and really rich people that we will adjust to their economic plan. And so when they talk about eliminating massive numbers of jobs via automation, they know that our instinct will be to work harder for less. We will take on the second and the third job. We will, and this is amazing, I know this will, you know, this will seem unimaginable to you, but we'll take our cars and go out and put like an Uber sign on them and drive around and try and make money picking up people and dropping them off. And then we'll take our spare room and we'll call it Airbnb. They know that we will extend ourselves as far as we can to survive economically. And they see in that the last great stage of redistribution of the wealth upwards. They don't see a dystopia. What they see is more opportunities to get more money out of the great majority of us. And I know you're saying, well, Mr. Nichols, that's kind of a dark thought. And I don't believe it. I just don't buy it. I have just enjoyed a tasty treat over at Starbucks. And I don't think these are all, I don't really think they're thinking that way. And so let me offer you an example. Because I know it's sometimes hard to see it in pictures. How many of you have ever heard of the company Kodak. Now, raise your hands. Don't be embarrassed. That's right. You must have heard of Kodak. Kodak is an American company. It even did stuff in Canada. And like all American companies. So Kodak, in 1988, had 145,000 employees. 145,000 employees in the U.S., Canada, a few other countries around the world. And they were a great employer. Most of the jobs were unionized. Those who were in non-union capacities generally had, you know, really good salaried work. They had a huge research department where they literally explored the digital technologies that would transform photography. Most of what we do on our phone with pictures has roots in what Kodak's research department did in 1988, back when they had 145,000 employees. In 2012, Kodak went bankrupt. Great big company, everybody, just about everybody in the room knows the name. They went bankrupt. Why did they go bankrupt? Because despite the fact that they actually treated their workers well and that they developed the technologies of the future, other people harnessed those technologies, including the folks who did a little thing called Instagram. How many of you have heard of Instagram? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, interesting thing happened right around the time that Kodak went bankrupt. Instagram got bought by Facebook. Now, Facebook is one of these big monopoly companies of the future. We've recreated the Gilded Age. We now have corporations that, you know, literally feed on themselves and grow bigger and bigger and bigger. They have bigger economic footprints than countries and even regions of the world. The way they get that way is not by treating their workers well and not by doing really smart things. They buy other companies that might compete with them and integrate them in. So Facebook buys Instagram. Logical thing to do. Same time that Kodak was going bankrupt. When that purchase for about $1 billion came down, they had to release their paperwork. Now remember, this is the company that developed technologies that essentially wiped out that company that had 145,000 jobs, presence all over the world, did all this stuff. Guess how many jobs Facebook had at the point where it was, I'm sorry, Instagram had at the point where it was sold to Facebook. You look like a smart guy. What do you say? I'm not going to embarrass you. What? 1,000. Excellent. I like you. Okay, anybody else got a number? Oh, ho, 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 ho. Ho, ho, ho. Who's the 13? That's him right there. They had 13 jobs. So you took a company with 145,000 jobs, you developed some digital technology, some applications for it, and you end up with 13 jobs. Now, on balance, that doesn't sound so good. And you say to yourself, well, who's doing all the work that Kodak used to do, right? They used to process pictures, they used to do all this stuff. Who is doing all that? We are. We have done, it's incredibly enough, we have said, give me this app. Let me put this in my phone. Let me process all these photos. Let me do all the stuff you used to do for free, and I will pay you money. In some areas, plus I'll give you all my information so you can sell it to other people. And you're like, oh, Facebook says, okay. That sounds good to us. That's a pretty good relationship. Well, brothers and sisters, that's where we're headed. This is not complicated stuff. It's not stuff that requires some deep understanding of technology. You simply have to understand how capitalism works. And interestingly enough, no matter what they tell you, this is the biggest issue of your future. No matter what you do, this is the biggest issue of your future. Not because it's more important than other issues, it's less important than other issues. But until you get on top of this, everything else about your life will be warped by what happens in the next 10 to 20 years. And you know what's interesting about it? In America, where I come from, and we are not quick on catching on to things, but we have figured it out. No, it's just that we don't know that we figured it out. This year, we're having a great big national election. And the funny thing about America is that unlike Canada, where you can have an election in private, right? In America, we make our elections international. Everyone has to watch our pathologies play out. Doesn't matter where you live, we share it with you. And, you know, like, I've been in the most remote parts of the world, and people go, yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure about that Rubio guy. And, you know, people around the world watch our elections much more than they should. I actually watch Canadian elections and enjoy them. And then I write articles about them in The Nation magazine in the U.S., and people get mad at me. No, Americans get mad at me. They're like, you know, like I said, you know, this Justin Trudeau guy, who I know is imperfect in a whole bunch of ways, but he does some really great, you know, dances. He's a good dancer. He looks fabulous. And he did that thing on the escalator where he explained economics. And I wrote about that in America. And I said, you know, this is the kind of leader we should maybe be looking for, somebody that could explain economics on an escalator. And like, literally, I had tons of people in America who said, don't you tell us that we don't know how to do our stuff. This was last year, right? And they're saying, don't you think that Canadians can do things better than us? And so, to respond to that, I gave them Trump. Just to prove something. But the interesting thing about the American election that's playing out right now, which I do not have to explain to you because we force it on you whether you like it or not, the American election that's going on right now has a phenomenon in it that nobody seems to be able to understand. All of our media is like, we are flummoxed. We have no idea what is going on. This is amazing. People seem to be incredibly angry. What are they angry about? What would bother them so much? And they're like completely confused because young people are supporting a 74-year-old Democratic socialist from Vermont, which is almost Canada. And they're like, hold it. This is not, you know, first off, unlike, we never had the Tommy Douglas thing, so we don't know about socialism in America, except that, you know, Eugene Debs, but that was a long time ago. And so we don't get that. And we especially don't get that young people are all into this guy because he doesn't tell a lot of jokes. He basically just talks about a really lousy economic circumstance. Why do they go and cheer? Why do 85% of them vote for Bernie Sanders in primaries? Right now, literally, he is winning 85% of the votes of people under 30. Like, stunning. That, as Bob says, that's like North Korea level of political engagement, except the North Koreans know that it's not real, you know, whereas Americans take it more seriously. Anyways, so he's getting this huge level of votes. Now, that's something that's pretty significant. Why are they so freaked out about the future? Why do they vote for this guy? And why, then, do their grandparents vote for Donald Trump? Why do, you know, people in their 50s and 60s, why are they, like, feverishly excited about Donald Trump? So what could possibly cause this phenomenon? Well, people under 30 have grown up marinated in this digital technology. They actually know a lot about automation and about artificial intelligence and all the things that are coming our way. People who are like 50 or 60 or 70, often they know very, very little about it. But the interesting thing is, they're both terrified by it. They are both absolutely terrified by the prospect of a future in which they don't have a place. And if you're a 22-year-old who's in America logging in at like $200,000 in debt from going to some private college, and literally, you know, your parents have supported you in your exploration of poetry and other exciting subjects, and now you're going to go into an economy, right? And that economy seems to hold out very few possibilities except driving an Uber car at midnight. And you're like, that's a good reason to be concerned, because you're right to be worried. But so is the 55-year-old guy who's been working in not his first job, right? Because that factory got closed, NAFTA. Remember, NAFTA's interesting thing, because I love talking about NAFTA in Canada, North American Free Trade Agreement, because, of course, we're your Mexico. And Mexico's our Mexico. And the interesting thing about it is I used to cover Canadian elections. And I remember in 1993 when NAFTA was in play, and there were in Windsor, Ontario, there were signs that said, "Don't do NAFTA or all our jobs will be exported to the United States." And in the United States, of course, they said all our jobs are going to be exported to Mexico. And of course, we were both wrong because they all went to Canada. No. No, they actually went to China. And so the end result on all this, though, is that old guy, that older guy, he lost his job. Then he went to work in a warehouse. That warehouse has, in fact, automated. Now he's working at the 7-Eleven or the convenience store. And you know what? He's looking at the prospect that, you know, the sandwiches that they make or the whatever they're doing, that might be done by a robot. In fact, we studied for the book all of the we didn't read, you know, like the nice business journals. We read the nasty stuff. The studies and reports done for commercial groups, right? You know, for like the people who run quick food stores or gas stations, stuff like that. And you know what they all said? They say, you know, if you have an alternative here. You can pay your employees a living wage, or you can begin to look at the wonderful world of automation, because you can automate if the costs are right. And you know where it's happening? All over the world. Number one place it's automating right now is China, not the United States, not Canada. China's automating like crazy. Why? Because they are now, through global trade agreements, they're now in competition with Vietnam and Myanmar and Bangladesh. And so China is trying to automate rapidly so that they don't have to pay workers at the, you know, exorbitant wages of people get in Myanmar. And so this is happening all over the world. The old guy knows it. The kid knows it. The only people that don't talk about it are our media and political elites. Why don't our media and political elites talk about it? Because it's really scary, and if we did talk about it, it's the only thing we would talk about. We would suddenly lose interest in Donald Trump's hand size. I mean, if you follow this, you probably haven't because you actually have other things to do. But in America, we're actually arguing about whether the hand size equates to anything else. And they're literally arguing about this stuff, and that our media loves. Our media adores it because our media has already been automated, right? Our media, we've culled out tens of thousands of journalists. We've literally, now what we have is a bunch of people who want clicks or ratings. And they are so desperate for clicks and ratings that if you tell them there's a crazy billionaire who's going to talk about how his hand size equates to his endowments, they're like, okay, we're going there. We're down that road. And the fact of the matter is, to give you an example of how real this is in America, how our media system has already been transformed into pure personality, no economics, no serious conversation. They did a study at the end of last year, and they studied the number of minutes that were devoted to Donald Trump versus the number of minutes that were devoted to Bernie Sanders. Now, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are polling at the exact same place. Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are literally disrupting each of their political parties in the same way, right? Totally throwing things off. They're literally polling in the exact same place. Donald Trump, 240 minutes. Bernie Sanders, I'm sorry, Donald Trump, 80 minutes. Bernie Sanders, 1 minute. Donald Trump, 80. Bernie Sanders, 1. But here's where it got interesting. We then took the data and looked at it. 1 was, for Bernie Sanders, was the rounded up number. He had actually gotten 20 seconds, and Donald Trump had gotten 80 minutes. So that's where 240-1 ratio, 240-1. Those numbers have continued to play out. There's a reason why Donald Trump is probably going to be the Republican nominee for President of the United States of America, because the media has covered the hell out of the guy. They literally have been obsessed with him. The problem is they've never bothered to begin to look at the intersection of why Sanders and Trump are doing so well. Sanders is doing well because he promises a future you can believe in. He simply says, you know, vote for me. I don't have all the answers, but I'm a democratic socialist, and if you put me in charge, I'm not going to give it away to the corporations. A lot of young people like that. Trump has said, make America great again. The operative word is again. What he means by that is, I'm going to take you back to those days before all the immigrants came and before all the people that I like to blame for everything I don't like came, right? So before there were immigrants, before there were Muslims, before there were minorities, before any of those things existed, that's where I'm going to take you to. Now, you have to be pretty dumb to fall for that, or I would argue, pretty desperate. And the desperation level in America is incredibly high. It's a desperation level rooted in the changes that are taking place. We don't hear anybody talking about it, and we don't have a media that draws us into that conversation. It's a crisis circumstance. So what do you want to do? Should we just hang it up?
Yep.
All right, sister. I'm with you. But on the theory that you might want to do something about it, and you might even be a little depressed at this point, a little down, right? Can I tell you, we've been here before and before and before and before. This happens all the time. This is actually, we do a lot of the book is devoted to this. This is really how history evolves. Amazingly enough, I know it's hard to believe, but history isn't all about rich white guys. It really isn't. Rich white guys and generals are not the definitional players in history. What is definitional is economic and social and technological change. And technological change is usually at the heart of it. 200 years ago, we had an industrial revolution. That industrial revolution was every bit as jarring, although it happened much more slowly and ultimately changed things in smaller ways, but it was as jarring as the digital revolution of today in many, many ways. And if you think back 200 years ago, the economic center, the machine center of the world was Lancashire in England. And the people who lived in the little villages around Lancaster in the north of England, the people who lived in those villages had really cool jobs. Not great jobs, they didn't make a fortune, but they lived in little villages and they sewed and they worked on little looms and stuff out in behind the house and in little sheds, and they made clothing and they made all sorts of stuff. And they were actually remarkably creative. And then somebody got an idea to get bigger machines, bigger looms into factories. And they had to leave their villages, leave their children, leave what they knew, and go and begin to be pulled into this industrial experience. There's a reason why William Blake referred to them as dark, satanic mills. Because Blake believed that all human connection, all the good of who we were, would be squeezed out of us by this repetitive work in the dark, satanic mills. The people had a very good reaction to that. They got big, heavy hammers, and they went to the mills and they smashed the machines. They literally broke up machines. They were called machine breakers. They were called Luddites. They had a hero who they referred to as Captain Swing. And the thing was, Captain Swing was a guy who swung the hammer hardest to break the machine. They actually did something fascinating, which we would never do in America. They held CEOs to account. If you ran one of these mills, they actually had people's arrests of the owners of mills. They would drag them out and try them for the economic crimes that they were committing to humanity. The British government did not like this. There's a time, we write about this in the book, there was a time that they had more British troops in Lancashire than fighting Napoleon. They put down the revolts of the Luddites. Because you know what? Every time you revolt against technology, you lose. That is core reality of history. You're going to lose. Trying to stop technology doesn't work. But what we write about in the book is what happened to those who tried to break the machines. They went back to their villages, they worked in those long, hard jobs, and at night they would gather in clubs. They had these clubs all over England. And they eventually, over time, began to call themselves Chartists. And they argued that there would need to be a people's charter that would restore not just their economic liberty, but their democratic power that would give them power over those, not just who ran the government, but over those who literally ran the machines, those who had the economic power of their time. And the Chartist movement in England pulled together all of the little Luddite clubs and all of the dissident groupings, and it took a long time for it to work. But they implemented universal suffrage. Every male got to vote. Then they began to extend the franchise more and more. They changed the political processes of their country to make it more small d democratic. Slowly, they opened the door to trade unions. They opened the door to social welfare state. And over time, they even said, you know what? You should only have to work 8 hours a day. You should only have to work 5 days a week. You should make enough money so that when you work 40 hours a week, you actually have a decent living. And they used this crazy thing, democracy, to tame the Industrial Revolution, which they saw as every bit as daunting as what we face today. And I just want to tell you folks, what we're coming into is going to be really scary. It's going to be really daunting. If you don't believe that, then you're not looking forward in a very clear way. There are going to be tech utopians who tell you that we're going to create all kinds of new jobs, right? And those new jobs are going to be great, and we're just going to do better things. Wrong. That's ridiculous. Of course, if that was the case, then everything that capitalism is about is failing, right? Because the point isn't to create all sorts of new jobs and pay you a lot of money. The point is to get you to work harder, longer, and then redistribute more of your earnings, more of your wealth, upward. That's the whole point of it. And so if we accept that reality, the point of what we do has to be to open up our political processes in ways as they have never been opened before, and to recognize that we need to win the future. Now, how do we win the future? The first thing we have to do is have a media system that actually informs us about what's going on. And so the battle for a free and open media becomes an absolutely central part of this struggle. We cannot say to people that a cacophony coming out of your phone is going to give you all the information you need. You need more than that. You need journalism. You need people who actually go out and gather information and provide it to you. But then you also need democratic processes that reflect your demands. We have to break the lie of the neoliberal era. The not lie of the neoliberal era, which goes back quite a while, is that we can make decisions about our lives as long as it doesn't affect the economics of the wealthy, right? That we got a lot, as much democracy as you want, as long as some rich guy is not in any way harmed by this. It has been so effective that we actually had austerity. It's been so effective that you people elected Stephen Harper. No, I mean, this is crazy stuff, right? And so what has happened is that we have fallen into a set of narrow thoughts about where we're going. The times we're coming into are not going to allow for narrow thoughts. There is no narrow way out of this. There's a great big way. And I know that, as I conclude, you're going to say, well, that all sounds really good. You know, kind of it's a little more optimistic than when we were talking about all the Kodak jobs. I'm liking that. You know, the Moore's Law thing scared me a little, but maybe we can slow it. You know, okay, let me offer you this last notion. The last thing we do in the book is actually chart what everybody is already doing. And that's the most encouraging thing. We are not the Luddites. We're not stuck in our little village in the north of England. We actually do have access to a tremendous amount of information. We actually have a huge number of people in Vancouver, British Columbia, who have come out on a Sunday night to try and wrestle with these kinds of issues. You have groups like Open Media and others that are doing this work, Ricochet, this wonderful media project here, all these cool things that are happening. And you know what else? We have living wage movements. In America, we call them $15 and a union movements. We have Black Lives Matter movement in America and similar movements here. You have wonderful Native Canadian rights movements and Native peoples who have risen to make real demands. You have wonderful immigrant rights movements in the U.S. and in Canada and elsewhere. The fact of the matter is, when you start to look at everything that is happening, it's huge. It's absolutely huge. We have the movements we need. The problem is, they're not hooped together. And we, in the book, we take a wonderful phrase from one of our most imperfect presidents, Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson, in the 1790s, at a point of economic turbulence and change, early Industrial Revolution period, Jefferson was faced with the reality that our American Constitution was being ripped up by one of the worst presidents of the history of our country, John Adams. And John Adams was a horrible man who was a petty royalist, And he was literally arresting journalists and arresting political enemies. And Jefferson was his vice president, but turned against him and actually led a campaign to stop him. And one of Jefferson's friends wrote to him, and he said, "This is really bad. You know, they're literally putting our people in jail. They're literally shutting our newspapers down. They're making it impossible for us to communicate. They're making it impossible for us to organize. We are becoming an authoritarian state." And Jefferson wrote back, he had this wonderful line. He said, "In a little bit of time, the reign of the witches will pass. People will awaken to the truth of what is happening to them. And they will begin to talk to one another. And they will say, it does not have to be this way. And when we begin to hoop all the people who say, it does not have to be this way together, not simply through intellect, but through experience, where they are actually driven by what is happening to them, the loss of jobs, the transformation of our lives, when we begin to hoop them together, we will prevail. The truth of the matter is, everyone who has ever written optimistically about technology, about technological progress, has said that it can and should free humanity to work less, to spend more time with our children, with our families, with our friends, to be more creative, to live better lives. Technology is not supposed to be a prison. We are not supposed to be gadgets. Technology is supposed to free us. And we are supposed to use technology to live better lives. But the way that that will happen is if we seize control of our politics and through that seize control of our economy so that it is our future, not theirs. Thank you very much.
That was John Nichols, media theorist and speaker at the Who Will Win the Digital Revolution, an event which took place on March 6th at the Vancouver Public Library. Also earlier in the address, you heard Robert McChesney. Both of them co-authored the book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. It was a fundraiser for Open Media and Media Democracy Days. Thanks to Joshua Robinson for his help preparing this podcast. You've been listening to Needs No Introduction, Fresh Ideas from Speakers of Note, a podcast of Rabble.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner. Thanks for listening.